All right, so my name is Andy Mammon. I'm a neurologist and neuromuscular specialist. I see patients at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. I also see patients at the Johns Hopkins Myositis Center. I wanted to start today by just telling you how I approach patients who I suspect have muscle disease. And really the first question that comes to my mind is, does the patient in front of me have a genetic muscle disease? That is a disease that's caused by some genetic defect that is now making them weak? Or do they have an acquired myopathy? That is something that they weren't born with that is now making them weak. And among the different categories of acquired myopathies, number one would be the autoimmune myopathies. And amongst the autoimmune myopathies, there are several different subtypes. And the major types are dermatomyositis, sporadic inclusion body myositis, and polymyositis. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about polymyositis. So how do we define whether a patient has polymyositis or not? The most accepted criteria for determining whether somebody has polymyositis is called the Bohan and Peter criteria. And there are four different things that physicians will look at. Number one, do you have proximal muscle weakness? That is the weakness greatest in the hip flexors, which would make it difficult for you to get up from a chair or go upstairs? Or is the weakness in your deltoid muscles, which might make it difficult to raise your arms above your head? That would be the typical pattern of weakness for somebody who has polymyositis or an acquired myopathy. In contrast, if a patient has distal weakness, such as weakness in their hands or feet, that would point to another process rather than polymyositis. So that's the first thing. Does the patient have proximal muscle weakness? Number two would be, does the patient have elevated muscle enzymes? So what are muscle enzymes? These are proteins that live in muscle cells. And because normally your muscle cells are intact, those proteins stay in the muscle and don't leak out into the blood, or at least not very much. In patients who have polymyositis, where the muscle cells are actually breaking open, the muscle enzymes leak out and actually cause increased muscle enzyme levels in the blood or serum. So we will check the serum or blood to see whether patients have elevated muscle enzymes. The most common muscle enzyme that we check is called creatine kinase, or CK. You may have heard of that, and doctors typically check that at the time of diagnosis, but also during the course of treatment to see whether patients are having less CK elevations as they're treated. So what else would we look at? Number three would be the results of a test called an electromyogram, or EMG. That's a test where the physician will put tiny little needles in different muscles and look to see what kind of muscle activity there is. And in the most simplistic terms, this allows the physician to determine whether there's a muscle problem or a nerve problem, because the EMG can look very different depending on whether it's a muscle problem or a nerve problem. If it looks like a muscle problem, that's the third bit of evidence that would suggest you could have polymyositis. The fourth thing that is looked at would be the results of a muscle biopsy. So patients with autoimmune muscle disease, including polymyositis, usually have inflammation of the muscle or necrosis of the muscle. Necrosis just means cell death. And so that would be the fourth thing that would be looked at to determine whether you have polymyositis. Now, the fifth thing that people will look at is whether or not you have skin involvement. So there are some very characteristic rashes that are found in some patients who have autoimmune muscle disease. That would be the Gottron's rash, which is found on the knuckles of patients, or a heliotrope rash, which is found around the upper eyelid of patients. To have polymyositis, you have to not have those two skin features, because if you have either the heliotrope rash or Gottron's papules, you have a different disease called dermatomyositis. So those are really the four criteria. You don't necessarily have to have all four of those criteria, but if you have three out of the four criteria, it's very probable that you have polymyositis. Now, once you've been given a diagnosis of polymyositis, there are yet different subtypes of polymyositis. So you may have heard of immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy. That is a form of polymyositis where there's very little inflammation in the muscle, but the cells necrose or die. And so that's why it's called a necrotizing myopathy. Another type of polymyositis would be patients who have the antisynthetase syndrome. Antisynthetase is a type of autoantibody that some patients have. And patients with the antisynthetase syndrome have one of those antisynthetase autoantibodies and usually have polymyositis or muscle involvement, but can also have other organ system involvement. A common organ that's involved in those patients would be the lung. So you may have heard of interstitial lung disease, which is a type of fibrosis of the lung that's thought to be autoimmune in nature. And that occurs in some people with polymyositis. Arthritis is another manifestation of the antisynthetase syndrome. And so patients may have polymyositis and have not just muscle involvement, but also joint and lung involvement as well. And again, that is the antisynthetase syndrome, which is a specific form of polymyositis. Other patients may have polymyositis and another autoimmune disease. So you might find somebody who has polymyositis and, say, rheumatoid arthritis, which affects their joints, or lupus, which is another autoimmune disease. And those are called overlap syndromes, where a patient has, again, polymyositis with another disease. So because of how these diseases are defined, that will kind of determine the testing that each patient undergoes. So most likely when you come to see the physician and they're trying to determine whether you have polymyositis, they will perform a physical exam and muscle strength testing to determine whether you have the typical pattern of weakness found in patients with polymyositis. They'll also perform blood work, and most likely they'll check a CK level to see whether there is elevated muscle enzyme in your blood. They may also look for some of these autoantibodies that are found in myositis patients, and they'll probably send you for an EMG, which some people find painful, other people find not too much trouble at all, but it is a often necessary part of the process to determine whether or not you have polymyositis. And finally, especially if the diagnosis is at all in doubt, many patients will undergo a muscle biopsy, and a little piece of muscle will be taken usually from the deltoid or the biceps or one of your quadriceps muscles and sent to a pathologist to be read. And they'll be looking for the characteristic features of polymyositis, which, as I said before, would either be inflammatory cells or muscle cell necrosis found on the muscle biopsy. So what happens once you've been diagnosed with polymyositis? The most important thing is to make the correct diagnosis so the appropriate treatment strategies can be instituted. And by far, the most common medication that's used to treat all these different forms of polymyositis would be corticosteroids, or prednisone being the most common. So it would be not uncommon and very frequent that physicians would choose to start polymyositis patients on an oral steroid, or sometimes, if the disease is more severe, intravenous corticosteroids. Unfortunately, corticosteroids, as good as they are for treating polymyositis, also have lots of side effects. So physicians will like to use them at the beginning and then really minimize their use as the disease comes under better control. Usually this is done by adding another type of medication. There are three medications, all oral medications usually, that are frequently given to polymyositis patients, sometimes at the very beginning of the disease or sometimes as the corticosteroid dose is being reduced. Methotrexate is one of these medications. The second medication would be a medication called azathioprine. The third medication would be mycophenolate or Cellcept. Now, each of these three medications are a little bit different, and one of the important decisions your doctor has to make is which one of these to try. And that really depends on the individual and the type of myositis that they have. But usually one of those three would be started. Some patients, for reasons that we don't understand, may not respond to one or several of those different medications. In that case, we can turn to some other medications that also can work very well for polymyositis patients. One medication that we would typically use is called intravenous immunoglobulin, or IVIG, which is given as an IV and can be very effective in treating patients who have polymyositis. One of the advantages of IVIG is that, like corticosteroids, it works very quickly to bring the disease under control. Finally, another medication that is frequently used for polymyositis patients is called rituximab. This is a medication that's given as an infusion, and usually those infusions just need to be repeated once or twice more each year. So those are just some of the medications that we have at our disposal, but probably the most common ones. People often ask me, how am I going to respond to therapy? Am I going to get back to normal? Am I always going to be sick? What can I expect? Unfortunately, when patients first come to me, I'm unable to predict exactly how they can do after getting their medication. But as a rule of thumb, I usually say that most patients that I see respond pretty well to immunosuppressive therapy, like I've described. Probably a third of them respond so well that while they're on treatment, there's no evidence of active disease. That is, I can't really tell that they have disease when they come in because they're being treated so well. Another third or maybe half of patients will respond very well to treatment but may have some residual disease. And I can see that when I examine them. So they're not perfectly back to normal. And a smaller percent, maybe 10 to 20% of patients, have what I would refer to as difficult to treat disease, where we need to add multiple medications. They may continue to have significant problems even though they're being aggressively treated. So it's unfortunate that I can't tell people exactly how they're going to do. The other challenge that we face is that when I first see patients, I don't know exactly which medications they're going to respond to. So you should consider each new trial sort of a process of trial and error to determine whether that drug's going to work for you. And working means not just treating the disease, but also having minimal and tolerable side effects. I won't go into the details of all the side effects of all the different medications, but each of them has a certain set of potential side effects, and our goal is to sort of manage the side effects versus how much benefit they're giving individual patients. So that sort of brings me to my next topic, which is, what about therapies in the future? You know, you tell me that some patients don't respond to treatment. What hope do they have? Well, right now, we treat all these diseases by broadly suppressing the immune system. So corticosteroids and the other drugs I mentioned really suppress the entire immune system. And I think that the next wave of effective medications for polymyositis are going to be based on us having a better understanding of the precise mechanisms that drive the disease. And when we understand the precise mechanisms that drive this autoimmune disease, we should be able to find targets for new medications that should be more effective at treating polymyositis but have fewer side effects. And that is really our ultimate goal, to take patients who have these diseases, treat them with medications that make them better, able to function and able to enjoy their lives, hopefully without any limitations, and really have minimal, if any, side effects. So that's sort of the holy grail of where we're going with research into polymyositis. And I think that as we make continued progress in understanding these diseases, we have reason to be optimistic and hopeful that new and more effective therapies are on the way. So thank you for your attention, and I wish you the